I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. My friends, we've reached the end of our first season and our journey through 2,500 years of slavery. There was so much more we could have explored, so many different stories and experiences. People bound for Brazil, a destination for far more enslaved Africans than the American South. The boys taken from their homes in Serbia or Anatolia and placed into the barracks of the Ottoman Janissaries, the Sultan's elite slave soldiers. The enslaved servants who accompanied the Prophet Muhammad. The scribes and secretaries of the imperial household who kept the Roman Empire running. Enslaved people were everywhere, sometimes obvious in the historical and archaeological record, but more often hidden beneath the surface of the societies that enslaved them, the quiet backbone of empires, urban life, and modern civilization itself. In today's episode, the last of this season, we'll explore some of the broad patterns, themes, and revelations that have emerged from studying more than two millennia of enslaved life. I make no claims to being totally comprehensive here. These are just the aspects of the subject that stood out to me the most while researching, writing, and recording these episodes. I'm really curious to hear what was most striking to you as well as you came along with me. Let's dive in. The first aspect of slavery that stood out to me was something I alluded to at the very beginning here, just how ubiquitous slavery actually was in the human past. It was already clear to me all the way back in November when I started writing how misleading the concept of slave societies, those where enslaved people actually made up an obvious and essential part of the population, really was. Remember, in the canonical listing of slave societies, there were only five that actually met the criteria: ancient Greece and Rome, and then colonial Brazil, the Caribbean, and the American South. That's despite the fact that we already knew, and have since learned, of many more societies in which slavery existed and shaped the lives of those who experienced it. Where do we draw the lines that separate societies with slaves from slave societies? What percentage of the population has to be enslaved before we can make that call? How much economic activity do those enslaved people have to be responsible for? How bad do the conditions under which those enslaved people are living have to be before we can call it a slave society? This is why I advocated for the metric of intensity instead of just classifying whole times and places as slave societies or not. Intensity is more flexible. It allows us to look at many different aspects of social relations, economic activity, and health, comparing societies to one another across a variety of criteria. Slavery is like a terminal disease. It's always bad, but some iterations are indeed much worse than others. It doesn't diminish the awfulness of the merely bad to place it in conversation with the inhumane brutality we see in some cases. What's clear to me now in ways it wasn't before, even if I understood it in an intellectual, abstract sense, is just how many different societies have practiced slavery in some form. Whatever they called it, time and again, people have enslaved others, taken away their identities and pasts, and made them into more or less disposable labor to suit their needs. They've justified it in innumerable ways: as retribution for choosing the wrong religion, as a result of natural inferiority among the so-called races or varieties of humankind, like Aristotle's idea of natural slaves, and most commonly, as an expected, if unfortunate, consequence of the warfare that pervades interactions between human groups, the obvious consequence of a world in which might ultimately makes right. I think what stuck with me the most about that particular insight is just how little most people in the past did, in fact, try to explicitly justify enslavement. Sure, we see some full-throated intellectual defenses of slavery. Aristotle was pretty vociferous about it. Most early Christian theologians who gave it some thought came down on the side of acceptability. And obviously, the theorists in the antebellum South exalted their peculiar institution. But far more often, the fact of some people being owned by others was simply how things were. Nobody wanted to be a slave, but either some people were suited to enslavement by their nature, that was the more intellectual answer, or they'd gotten spectacularly unlucky in life, which seems to have been the more popular view. The obvious cognitive dissonance that resulted from some people being treated as less than human wasn't to attack the mistreatment, but to accept it as part of the background noise of living in a society. Leaving aside the implications of this view for the actual lived experiences of enslaved people, It's striking what it says about the human capacity to rationalize and justify truly awful things. It might have been uncouth for a respectable Athenian citizen to backhand one of his slaves in the agora while they were on their way to the assembly, but at the end of the day, nobody was going to stop him. Priests in Venice lamented that Venetian merchants and sailors were transporting enslaved Christians through their colonies in the Black Sea, but wasn't it better that the souls of Christian Circassian captives were being safeguarded by their fellow Christians rather than dastardly Muslims in Egypt or Syria? For Southern planters before the Civil War, the excesses of slavery were lamentable, but their model of a society of slaves and masters was, in the end, better for everyone, especially the slaves. These justifications should seem pretty thin to us, and frankly, they were pretty thin at the time. Aristotle, no matter how many unflattering things we might say about him, was the furthest thing from an idiot, and John C. Calhoun was a pretty savvy rhetorician. But that in itself is extraordinarily revealing. Nobody, or very few people, really wanted to start pulling at the threads that made up the tapestry of a world that relied on enslaved labor. Those that did very quickly found themselves making monstrous arguments. Slavery functioned much more smoothly when nobody was asking those questions at all. And for huge stretches of the period we examined in this season, effectively nobody was even posing them. I've been asked numerous times by listeners throughout the past few months about ancient abolitionists, whether there were antecedents and inspirations in the ancient or medieval worlds for the organized movement of the 18th and 19th centuries. There really weren't, with a couple of notable exceptions. St. Gregory of Nyssa, who wrote in the 4th century AD, articulated a full-blown condemnation of slavery on Christian theological grounds. Quote, "If man is in the likeness of God, who is his buyer? Tell me, who is his seller? To God alone belongs this power, or rather, not even to God himself. God would not therefore reduce the human race to slavery, since God himself, when we had been enslaved to sin, spontaneously recalled us to freedom. But if God does not enslave what is free, who is he that sets his own power above God's?" Gregory's points seem fairly uncontroversial when quoted today, particularly since the underlying ideas appeared so prominently among the abolitionists of the 18th and 19th centuries. But they had no purchase in antiquity. I cannot emphasize that enough. Gregory of Nyssa was a brilliant theologian, but he stands out in this regard not for the unique brilliance of the argument, but for the fact that he was the only one making it. I think we can be pretty sure that the sentiments he expressed, which aren't much of a jump from concepts woven into the New Testament, were floating around, perhaps expressed by enslaved people themselves. But those ideas had no real purchase in the intellectual, cultural, and religious mainstream. Even among the Cappadocian Fathers, the group of three towering theologians that included Gregory, his brother Basil of Caesarea, and Gregory of Nazianzus, Gregory of Nyssa was the least known of the three. We know his anti-slavery arguments now, in the present, precisely because they were so unusual. Now, there are a couple of different ways to think about this. Returning to something I mentioned a moment ago, I'd guess that there were a lot of enslaved people throughout history who did, in fact, make ethical or religious arguments against slavery as a whole system. Sitting in the barracks of Roman Latifundia after a long day of work, chatting before sleep in cramped quarters off a hot kitchen, lamenting the brutality of an overseer in hushed tones. Enslaved people were perfectly capable of articulating why the conditions of their lives were inherently unfair. We know they did so extensively in better documented periods, and it's safe to say they did so in the ancient and medieval worlds as well. Yet we have no equivalent to Olaude Equiano's interesting narrative from antiquity. We know of no Greek Frederick Douglass, and no renegade Mamluk ever wrote something like Solomon Northup's 12 Years a Slave. I don't think we can say that nobody ever did so, just that we don't have it, which isn't the same thing. It's almost more depressing in the sense that it tells us that those who came after them, if those works existed, didn't think that such work was interesting enough to copy down for later generations if they ran across it in a decaying manuscript. That right there is the heart of the matter. Even if those arguments were being made, nobody cared enough to ensure that they were being disseminated and passed down. Slavery was simply part of how the world worked, for better and worse, and even enslaved people aspired to one day own slaves of their own, to save them from the endless drudgery of work. For millennia, the dominant response to abducting people and forcing them to labor was plugging one's ears and simply hoping it didn't happen to them, not imagining a world in which that didn't happen to anyone. Coming into this, I knew that slavery was a vicious, awful institution. And the litany of brutality we've seen in the historical and archaeological record wasn't surprising to me. But it was still shocking. Even knowing what I was going to be reading and writing about, despite having a pretty good sense for what the individual stories I was going to tell would be, the sheer quantity of inhumanity I encountered between Nanaya Ila'i and Matilda McCreer was overwhelming. Nobody thinks the sack of a city or a raid on a village is pleasant, but it's an entirely different thing to hear firsthand accounts of watching one's family be killed, to glimpse the violent reality underlying the sterile language of military campaigns and supply and demand for captives. I'm not going to recount any more specifics here, but suffice to say the gap between the sterility and the blood it attempted to conceal grows into something approaching absurdity. Nobody needed slaves. Human societies are full of tasks that people don't particularly want to do, whether that's drawing water, gathering fuel for a fire, changing a diaper, mining silver, stoking a boiler, or cutting sugarcane. Abducting other people and making them do those tasks is a choice, not a necessity. And time and again, different societies have chosen to enslave people to serve their desires. The buyer in the marketplace was purchasing a commodity made through violence, and was on some level aware that the person they were buying didn't want to be a slave. They did it anyway, as a matter of routine. I do not have a particularly high opinion of human nature, whatever that's supposed to mean. I don't think we're the removal of the state or the end of capitalism away from sitting in a big drum circle and singing Kumbaya until dawn. Write about enough Neolithic mass graves, Paleolithic murders, and ancient infanticides, and you're not going to pine for some prelapsarian state of human innocence because there's never been one. Much of the human past, like the human present, is grim, dark, and bloody, and often more so. Despite the breadth and depth of my awareness of what people have done to each other over the millennia, the extent of what I saw here was profoundly affecting. For every trafficked individual whose experiences I was able to briefly explore, there were thousands who left not a single trace. For every child ripped away from its parents whose story I could tell, millions more remained unknown and silent. Each of those individual stories, no matter how terrible it might have been, was only the tip of an iceberg reaching miles down into the sea. No individual story could ever hope to truly convey its horror. The true horror, I realize now, lies in the scale of slavery as a system. It wasn't one person or warband or army, but the whole society. From the soldier who seized the captive at sword point to the baker who forced her to knead dough until she expired from a lung ailment brought on by the detritus in the air. The exemplary violence and dehumanization slavery meted out to its victims was fully routinized, an assembly line process for taking free people and shaping them into the thinking, speaking tools of their owners. While we can break apart those systems to tell individual stories, as I've done throughout this season, it's only when we put the system back together that we realize how pervasive it was. 12 million people suffered through the Middle Passage. We met only 111 of them, 110 on the Clotilda and Olaude Equiano. A not insubstantial portion of those millions had lived through something like the raid the Clotilda survivors described. Hundreds of thousands of people were enslaved around the time Terence was taken from North Africa to Rome, but Terence's was the only story I told. In the aggregate, millions upon millions of people over thousands of years and across most of the planet experienced enslavement. Every single one of those numbers was a person, and each of them was every bit as real as Terence, Olaude Equiano, Maddalena, and Urasaki's bakers. If doing that to a single person is a crime beyond imagining, what does it say that such mistreatment has been so pervasive for so long? Every captive had an enslaver. Owners benefited from their slaves' labor in uncountable ways, spared tasks they didn't want to do, their time freed to attend to the business of the Virginia House of Burgesses or the Roman Senate or a council of elders in the Igbo lands. From them down to the freedman baker looking to lighten his workload, the goldsmith who needed an extra pair of hands, and the returning soldier looking for a companion, whole societies were built on the delegation of drudgery to people who were taken in violence and forced to work. There was no presumption of equality, and the idea that some were better than others, and entitled to the labor of others, pervaded. The idea that human life has inherent value is extraordinarily recent and nowhere near as deeply rooted as we might prefer. For all its many failings, even the concept of universal human rights and its backing by the UN represents genuine progress. The shortcomings of international law that allow for the impunity of the many bad people who continue to get away with crimes against humanity are regrettable. Slavery still exists today in many forms, both open and covert, and it remains a stain on our collective soul that it does. We ought to fight against those shortcomings at every opportunity. But a world in which nobody is even paying lip service to those ideas is, in fact, much worse than what we have now. This seems important to recognize at a moment in which the rules-based international order is under assault from every direction and besieged in the United States. I am not saying the United Nations and the cornucopia of global organizations that underlie the idea of universal human rights are perfect. I'm not even saying they're particularly good. We can and should imagine better. They are, however, better than nothing. Think of the anti-slavery patrols of the 19th century, when the navies of the United Kingdom, United States, and other powers dispatched warships to interdict those who tried to flout the ban on slaving. Those patrols deterred some merchants from entering the trade altogether, captured others, and raised costs on those who did manage to evade them. The Clotilda's owners burned the ship to destroy evidence of their crime. These measures were never enough. The hundreds of thousands of people transported in defiance of the bans still suffered. And the colonialism visited on those same regions of Africa later in the century did not represent an improvement. Yet millions of people were spared at least the Middle Passage, the voyage that fattened the sharks of the Atlantic with the corpses of those who didn't survive, and lives of brutal, unceasing labor afterward. Without patting those responsible on the back too much, it's something. Drops in the bucket matter if those drops are the autonomy and humanity of living, breathing people. Human equality is an extraordinarily fragile idea. If your life matters, so does that of everyone else. An assault on the dignity of one person is an assault on all, not just for moral reasons, but as a matter of actual threat. If it can happen to someone else, it can happen to you. We are better off working for a world in which that bad thing happens to nobody than one in which we pray that we don't get unlucky. We can do better than the dour fatalism of making offerings and thanks for not having our villages burned. We can put our energy behind creating circumstances in which the idea of burning villages is a strange outlier rather than normal, lived experience. Awareness of the past is a fundamental component of making that better world. That requires us to tell the truth about the past, even, and perhaps especially, when it's uncomfortable. We should never think of the Parthenon or Forum or the Constitution of the United States the same way again. We are no better, blessed with no greater capacities in ethics or intelligence than the people who either enslaved or were enslaved for thousands upon thousands of years. The capacity to immiserate others to benefit themselves hasn't gone anywhere. Enslavement was a choice that living, breathing people made. People are making that choice today. It's hardly unthinkable that they would do so again on a larger scale in the future. When we see dehumanization and exploitation happening, the devaluing of human life for the benefit of others, it's incumbent on us to prevent that from taking root again, to yank out the sapling before it grows into a tree. Thanks so much for joining me for this first season of Past Lives. After a week's break, we'll be back with our second season. It's called Bodily Experiences, and each episode explores the life of a person we know through their remains. Skeletons, bog bodies, and mummies, the physical remnants of long dead people. Be sure and subscribe to our Patreon. It's only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content, like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's linked in the description here. It's thanks to subscribers that we can make this show. And if you're already a subscriber, you rule. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. Thanks so much for joining me for season one of Past Lives. I'll see you the week after next as we start season two. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.